Hi, this is Perry, and you're listening to the Chemist's Corner podcast for Thursday, February 25th, 2010. Welcome to Chemist's Corner. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, and I'll be doing the show solo as my co-host, Kelly Dobos, couldn't join us today. This will sometimes happen when you work with the coolest cosmetic chemist in the whole world. Chemist Corner is a podcast about cosmetic science and is broadcast to help educate, entertain, and inspire current and future cosmetic scientists. The information and opinions discussed on Chemist Corner are those of the hosts and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect those of any past, present, or future employers. In this episode, we will be interviewing cosmetic chemist Amanda Foxen Hill, who is the creative force behind a company called Realize Beauty. We'll talk to her about how she became a cosmetic chemist, how she started her own company, and where she sees the best opportunities in cosmetic science. We'll also be covering a listener's question, discuss the top 10 problems in hair care, have a weekly challenge, but first, some cosmetic science news. There was a bill proposed in Colorado which could have an impact on anyone who creates cosmetics or personal care products for sale in Colorado, Colorado being one of the 50 states in the United States out west where they have all the mountains. Anyway, the Colorado Safe Personal Products Act prohibits manufacturers from knowingly selling, offering for sale, or distributing in Colorado any personal care product that contains a chemical identified as causing cancer or reproductive toxicity. Ooh. On the surface, it sounds like a reasonable law. Actually, you might even wonder why something like this isn't already a law. But if you think about it, you'll see why if a law like this passes, it will make formulating cosmetics and personal care products practically impossible. First, the law is too vague. It is not such a simple task to figure out if a chemical causes cancer or reproductive toxicity. For example, some ingredients may be shown to cause cancer only when injected in high concentrations, but be perfectly fine when topically applied. To pass a law like this, you need clear definitions on what would constitute causing cancer. Now, California got around this problem with their Proposition 65 law by making a list of chemicals they determined to cause cancer. This would be an important step for the Colorado bill, so manufacturers would clearly know whether they are in violation of the law or not. Ideally, scientists would be involved in creating the list rather than fear-mongering activist groups. Sadly, the activist groups usually get more say than the science. Another problem is that there are many naturally occurring compounds that have been determined to cause cancer, or some components of them have. For example, formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is produced naturally in our body, and it's even naturally found in some foods. So you have to wonder, will natural ingredients that contain potential carcinogens fall under this ban? It's really not clear the way that the law is proposed. Now, one of the biggest problems would be lead, which is thought to cause cancer and other developmental problems. Nobody wants lead in their products. But, unfortunately, lead is everywhere, including in your drinking water. The EPA actually has limits for the amount of lead allowable in water. If the law is passed as it is, you technically wouldn't be able to use water in any of your formulations. Imagine how cosmetics would change if you couldn't use water. This gets to one of the fundamental problems with all of these chemical scare stories. They ignore one thing. It's the dose that matters. Any chemical can be harmful at a certain level. Even natural spring water can be toxic if you have too much. The dose makes the poison, as does the method of exposure. Something topically applied might be perfectly fine, but injected or ingested, it could be harmful. Zero tolerance laws just do not work, nor do they make sense. First, it is impractical to remove all traces of all chemicals known to be toxic. Second, there is no evidence that if you could remove all traces of these chemicals, that the products would actually be safer. When it comes down to it, you could be doing all this work and it could just be a complete waste of money. Setting limits just makes much more sense to me. As cosmetic chemists, we certainly don't want to create products that are hazardous to people's health. But we should use science to make this determination, not half-baked ideas of politicians and misinformed fear-mongering activist groups. Let's move on to our next segment, a reader's question. We got this email from Celso, and Celso writes, how do freeze-thaw cycle stability tests work? How many cycles do you need? How many days, weeks, or months should you do them? Thanks. First, we should tell you about stability testing, because stability testing wasn't something that you learned about in college. Essentially, stability testing is just a study that you run to demonstrate that your product will stay the same over time, or at least it won't break down significantly. This is useful because when you make your product, you want it to continue to work when it's on the consumer's shelf or in their bathroom. Stability tests help us determine this. Now, freeze-thaw stability testing is a specialized type in which you freeze your product and then you thaw the formula out and you see what effect that has on your formula. The reason you do freeze-thaw stability testing is because it gives you information that regular stability testing doesn't. Namely, it shows you whether your formula will remain stable under conditions that it might experience during the shipping and storage of your product during its product life cycle. You see, it's likely that your product is going to be shipped by trucks or rail cars, and these vehicles are rarely equipped with temperature controls. So it's likely that your product could freeze one day, be in hot temperatures the next day, and it's crucial that when you formulate, your product is able to withstand these rapid changes of temperature. While there's no right way to do a freeze-thaw test, the method I use is pretty standard in the industry, and it should give you the information you need if you follow it. So the way I did it is you take four samples. You'll have three test samples and one control. You take initial readings on all of them, and this is going to be pH, viscosity, appearance, odor. And then you put the test samples in the freezer for 24 hours. The next day you remove the samples, and then you allow them to thaw to room temperature. Next, you put the samples in an oven, that's say 50°C, for 24 hours. Then you remove the samples and allow them to equilibrate at room temperature. And when they have come to equilibrium, you take the readings, and that's the end of your first cycle. Ideally, your formula stays together. You'll want to do this for a total of three cycles, and if your product can withstand three cycles of this freezing and thawing, then you know you have a pretty stable product. When you're looking at your samples, you should make particular note to see if there's any separating at the top and bottom of your samples. And this is particularly important for emulsion products, because emulsions are most prone to separation. You may also test the products for performance characteristics, just to ensure that the formulas still work as you expect them to. Sometimes a formula doesn't look like it's changed, but it actually has. It doesn't foam as well, or it doesn't feel exactly the same way. Thanks also for your question, and if any of you have questions regarding cosmetic science, or anything else about cosmetic chemistry, feel free to contact us through the website, chemistcorner.com, and there is a Contact Us button where you can leave your question. In our next topic, we're going to talk about cosmetic science. Now, one of the most important things as a cosmetic chemist is to try to solve problems that consumers have. In today's show, we're going to talk about the 10 most significant problems in hair care. Now, these are the problems that if you as a cosmetic chemist can do something to solve these problems, you can make a lot of money. Of course, these are not easy problems, and the problems have been around for a long time. But if you're doing research in hair and hair products, these are excellent problems to work on. So number one is hair loss. It's a fact that everybody loses hair. You know, a lot of it is through natural shedding, but as you do get older, you get more hair loss, and hair loss can become permanent. If you could figure out some way to stop hair loss, well, you could be rich. Number two problem is unwanted hair growth. Now, this is kind of the opposite of the first problem, because people have hair in areas where they don't want hair, say a mustache where you didn't want to have it. Now, solutions like depilatories or shaving provide short-term temporary relief, but if you can figure out a way to stop hair growth more permanently, then you may become famous. Now, everyone's hair goes gray, well, almost everybody, and there are really only two ways you can handle it. You can use artificial hair color that has to be constantly reapplied, or you can just let it go gray. Now, if you can invent a way to either restart the natural hair color or apply hair color in a more convenient way than the current hair colors, you can make a lot of money. The fourth problem is that hair color changes. I'm not talking about gray hair in this case. Sometimes people just want to change the color of their hair, and they spend tons of money on changing the color of their hair. Unfortunately, that color goes away rather quickly. So if you could make a way that could change somebody's hair and keep it color changed or make it easily switched out, then you'll have a product that will revolutionize hair color. Another problem is the hair feels bad or it's in bad condition. Now, the only solution to this is the reapplication of hair conditioners. But if you could figure out a way to give people long-lasting conditioning, excellent feeling hair, you could radically change the hair care market. Conditioners are a little bit inconvenient to use. Number six problem, unruly hair or frizzy hair that's uncooperative. Now, conditioners help, but they don't stop hair from frizzing up during days of high humidity. There's still a lot of room to develop a product that really stops frizz and leaves hair feeling more natural. Number seven problem is thinning hair. Now, hair loss is one problem, but hair thinning also applies as people get older. The thinning comes both in the thickness of the hair fibers and the number of them. If you could figure out some way to keep hair full, maybe you could make your wallet full too. The number eight problem is lack of volume. A high percentage of people complain that their hair has no volume. These are people that have really naturally straight hair that just kind of lays flat on their head. Now, if you could figure out a way to give them permanent volume that doesn't involve curling irons and blow dryers, you could really make some money there. Another complaint is shine, problem number nine. Now, everyone claims that they can give you shine, but in reality, no product delivers the kind of shine that people are looking for. If you can find a way to make hair shine so much it sparkles like diamonds, then you'll have a truly innovative product worthy of saying 5 times, 10 times more shine. And finally, the 10th problem in hair care products is the time it takes to style. Some people take over an hour to get their hair into the style and the shape they want. It really eats up a lot of time. Now, some of this is because of their lack of styling skills and the speed at which their hair drives. You may not be able to teach them to style faster, but as a cosmetic chemist, maybe you could figure out some way to get hair to dry a little quicker or to be more manageable. So there you have it, 10 problems that you as a cosmetic chemist working in the hair care products could work on and solve that could really lead to revolutionary and breakthrough products. And I, for one, hope to see someone, maybe somebody listening out there, do it within my lifetime. Because hair care products haven't really improved that much in the last 20, 30, or even 40 years. This is an area of cosmetic science that could really use a boost of innovation. Amanda Foxenhill is a longtime cosmetic chemist who's worked in both Europe and Australia. She has experience formulating a wide range of products and is currently the director of Realize Beauty, which features a website dedicated to demystifying the cosmetics industry for the consumer. She works as an instructor for the Institute of Personal Care Science, which offers a certified diploma course in cosmetic chemistry. Additionally, she runs workshops called Cosmetic Kitchen for adults and kids, where they make a few basic cosmetic products. Her latest project is writing a book called Realize Beauty, which is a philosophical look at our relationships with our bodies. She is located in Australia, and we welcome Amanda to the show. Hello, Amanda.
Hi, Perry, and thanks for that beautiful introduction.
I've been a big fan of your blog for a long while now, and I thought it would be nice to get you on the show because you do talk about cosmetic topics in a way that's not found on the web.
Yeah, I have a unique perspective, I guess.
Exactly. Now, this show is really for people that are just kind of getting into the cosmetic business or even people who want to get into the cosmetic business. So one of the things I'd like to do in starting these interviews is just to talk about how you got into cosmetic chemistry and the kinds of things that you did. So why don't you just run us through how you got started in the cosmetic industry?
Okay, well, I did a chemistry degree, but purely because I was interested in chemistry, although I found it really hard. And I thought, look, it's too hard. I don't want to give up. I want to try more. So, yeah, I did my degree, passed that, and then needed a break. So went traveling, came back, and just applied for any jobs I could. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just knew that I liked chemistry. And I got a job in the cosmetics industry by default, really. They were the first people to offer me a job as a telesalesperson. And I was lucky enough to have my first boss was a lady called Tanya Ball, who's still in the industry, who was absolutely brilliant. She told me that a condition of taking the job was to do the UK diploma in cosmetic chemistry. And I thought, well, fair enough. Why not? Sounds interesting. And really, the rest is history. She was a great mentor. She did the course alongside me. And basically, it was the first time I'd ever actually been able to apply my chemical knowledge. So I'd always been interested in chemistry, but I'd never known quite how to apply it or what was going to appeal to me. So, as I said, I fell into the industry by default, but after about probably 3 weeks, you couldn't get me out of the cosmetic aisle. I was reading everything.
You had mentioned the online course you had taken. What is that one?
I did, the UK Society for Cosmetic Scientists has got a course that you can do. So I was in England at the time, and I did a correspondence course, which teaches you the basics of cosmetic chemistry. We looked at how perfumes worked, at how oils and fats were structured, basic manufacturing methods, all sorts of things really by correspondence. And then when I did the course, we had a summer school. So we all trooped off to Boots, the big Boots sort of company, and had, I think it was a long weekend of lectures and interactive study to really get the basics of, you know, how cosmetic science works. And at the end of that, you get a diploma.
So did the class actually meet together at some part, or was it just all online?
Yeah, look, most of it wasn't actually online. When I did it, it was all by book learning, and then you sent in your work and you basically sent in your essays and all that sort of thing and got it marked that way. And the summer school was the only time we all got together. So most of that learning was done on your own, and I was lucky enough. I worked for a chemical distributor. That was my first job. And we had a little lab, and I used to just probably naughtily sneak home some of our samples and try them out. So I turned my kitchen, much to my husband's, you know, dislike. He'd come home and find I'd been cooking and I'd been making all these different gels and different emulsions, and none of it was edible.
That is definitely the fun part of cosmetic science, just the formulating and just trying out all sorts of different kinds of product formulas.
Yeah, well, you see, I quickly decided that, you know, this was really fab and it's all great to learn about it on paper, but I used to have to sell ingredients. I mean, that's been my job pretty much all the way through, apart from now. And I'm one of those people, I never, ever can understand particularly what people are telling me unless I can try it. And also, I never believe anybody until I've tried it and seen it for myself, which is kind of bad, but it's just the way I think.
I think it's good to be skeptical.
Yeah, it was just like, well, I really wanted, you know, we'd sell, one of the first products I sold was the magnesium aluminum silicate, the thickener, the natural thickener. Mm-hmm. And couldn't work out how it was going to work. So I used to take that home and, you know, see how much force have you got to get in this thing to get it working, and you know, things like that. So it was really important for me to sort of turn that learning into something practical so that when I was talking to customers, I could understand where they were coming from.
Well, interesting. Now, when you were learning to formulate, how did you go about learning that?
Oh, trial and error completely. I actually adopted a few customers who were brilliant. I had a little patch of customers I looked after. And I'd just ring up and say, oh, can I come in? You know, I've been let out of the office. Can I come in and try this out? I want to show you this new ingredient, this new active or whatever. And they'd basically give me some tips. And I'd go home and I'd try and put the new Wonder Active in a little base. So it was purely trial and error. I used to try and absorb, I suppose, all the information about your emulsion stability and all that kind of thing. So it was a little bit of book work, but mostly I just used to get some samples and try stuff out. And then when it didn't work, I'd go and ask the professionals.
Now, when you say try things out, did you try all of the formulas that you put together?
Oh, yeah, I used to test. Yeah, my husband's nearly bald, so and he blames that on me. Right, you know when you get formulations from your suppliers when you get a new ingredient. So I used to go home and try them out, and then I'd say, well, what happens if I take that out and put that in? And I'd often make, I'd put glitter in everything just because I like glitter, and I'd make my husband try it out. Uh-huh. So yeah, he's very game, but he used to go and work in the woodworking factory with glitter in his hair because he couldn't get it out.
Yeah, I used to love to try products. I remember one year I was working on a shampoo and I probably washed my hair, you know, over 1,000 times that year.
Oh, yeah. You've got to do it. You see, because I always thought, I mean, being from a science sort of background, well, we're very analytical with chemistry and whatnot. Yeah, I never sort of want to do something just once. I have to try it again and again and then try it over a period of time, because I've done the same. I've made shampoos and thought, wow, this is great. My hair feels great after the first time. But if you stick with it, it actually gets worse and worse. So it's things like that that really... the whole process of developing a product really interests me, and the fact that even though it looks like you've got the right answer first off, you've got to do all your testing and keep trying things out to make sure that they're actually going to work on the long term. And that's where my interest in the consumer side of it comes from as well. So you make products that people actually want to buy rather than something that you think is clever but doesn't necessarily meet their needs.
Now, you had mentioned the consumer, and you essentially started your own business, Realize Beauty. So how did you make that jump?
Basically, I set up my own business because I could see a gap in understanding of science outside of the laboratory, I suppose. So the general public are becoming less and less able to understand what's going on. And that's not because people are stupid. It's because they're not given the right language and the right tools and the right opportunities. And products are becoming more and more complicated with your nanotechnology and your microemulsions and all of, you know, actives that can penetrate the skin and whatnot. So I really love communicating. I've always had a bit of a passion for getting up and teaching people and also listening and learning from others. So I decided that I've got two young kids and I wanted a bit more flexibility. I'd always worked in the corporate world, and as great as that was and as great the opportunities were, when you've got two young kids, and plus I'd emigrated, I'd come over to Australia and left my family, I sort of thought, well, maybe if I can do a bit of communications work, a bit of teaching, you know, have a bit of a play myself, I can earn enough money to keep us going and still be around for my kids.
Now, how long have you been writing Realize Beauty?
Oh, I've only been writing the articles for that for just over a year. But I worked out at Christmas that I'd wrote about, I think about 180,000 words, of which probably 120 are kind of rubbish.
Wow, but those 60,000.
They're the winners. They're gold.
You do these kitchen chemistry classes. Tell me about those.
Oh, basically, it stems back again from wanting to empower people to think differently about their products. So what I do is go out to people's either houses or places of works or charity groups, and we get out a whole heap of chemicals, mostly natural. So I have things like different vegetable oils, I have clays, things like citric acids and bicarbs, essential oils, all sorts of things like that, and just get people to play around with making their own products. So I have some basic recipes. We make toothpaste, we make bath bombs, what else do we do? And massage oils, and basically through making very simple products with ingredients that you can find in your kitchen or at your supermarket, I'm trying to develop an understanding of the language of chemistry, because and of cosmetic science, because people want natural products, but they don't understand what natural means. And then they want natural products that are safe and they can use and sell to their friends or give to their friends. And without really understanding, well, why does a cosmetic chemist put a preservative in? And, you know, oh, you want it to smell like roses? Well, you know, guess what? You might have to add a fragrance. And you break everything down to basics so that people feel empowered to make their own products. But then they start saying, well, this would be great if only I could, you know, if only I could sell it to my friends at the market. And then I say, well, actually, you can, but you've then got to do, that's why cosmetic chemists do this and this and this. So, it's all hands-on, and while people are making and playing, it really unlocks they're just playing with bits and pieces, and while they're playing, we can open up a conversation about why they're doing things.
And how is the response to those classes?
Oh, look, it's been brilliant. Everyone, the products we make are pretty high quality. Everything's packaged nicely and, you know, the ingredients are all fresh. So they've been delighted that they can actually make things. People are very excited about how easy it is to make basic things like, you know, your face packs and like basic products like that. But they also have said, well, they come away with a better appreciation of why products, when you look at an ingredient list, why there can be so many things in there. Because what we make, I tell people, look, it's only going to last, you make a little bit, it's only only going to last a few days, if not just use it today and dump it. Yeah, they've really been fascinated with the whole process, and it gives them another perspective when they go out shopping.
Yeah, well, it sounds great. I am not aware of anything, at least around me, where anyone's doing anything like that. So is there any chance you're going to package this up and take it on the road around the world?
Yeah, I'll come over and do it over there. Oh, look, I'd like it to go out wherever, really, wherever there's a need. But at the moment, we're limited to the Sydney area because there's only four of us who are trained to do the parties, and we're all based around, you know, the Sydney sort of regional area. But of course, we can have it anywhere.
That's right, you can franchise.
Cool, could do. Yeah, that's right. My motivation behind it is to get people thinking about science, and in particular cosmetic science, and then getting them opening up a conversation as to why the cosmetic industry does things and how they can make choices about the products that they use in an educated way. And I don't really mind how that message gets out to people. I mean, obviously, if I'm behind it, I make a bit of money, but that's not really the aim. The aim is to really set the scene for people to start thinking.
And ideally, if people are thinking, then the laws like the one that's being proposed in Colorado that you had written today, which proposes to ban any known carcinogen from all cosmetics at any level, maybe people won't be as afraid of these things.
Well, that's right. And I mean, that was one of my other motivating forces. I mean, you see, the cosmetics industry is kind of one thing, and then you've got a fraction of the cosmetics industry which calls itself, you know, something else completely, and they're campaigning for safe cosmetics. And what I think is we've really got to I always say that everyone wants safe products. Everybody. And cosmetic chemists are no different to anyone else out there. We're all looking for products that are safe and that don't contain carcinogenic material, and that are safe in the way that they're going to be used and the implications for the environment. But science doesn't always give you quick answers, and we don't always know what long-term implications are going to be. And we can guess and we can see, but when people are paralyzed by fear, really the only way is backwards. And I think we need, not just as an industry, I mean, we can talk about the industry, but then people get they think you're just trying to protect your own back, really. I mean, if you think about it from an individual, I've got kids. I don't want to poison my kids. I've got a nice garden. I don't want to see my flowers die. If more people understand basics of science and how science works, then, yeah, the law in Colorado would just become a bit like, well, we can question it a bit more, and we can say, well, look, you're wasting all that energy, or you're using all that energy. Maybe if we tweak this or do this differently, we can get a better outcome for everyone instead of just basically, yeah, wasting resources.
Would you have any advice for somebody new coming into the cosmetic industry, like how they get started or what kind of things should they be doing to, just get going in a career as a cosmetic chemist?
Well, yes, I would say that you sort of have a think about what type of thing interests you, because there's a lot of different roles in the cosmetics industry. I started off in a sales role and ended up, I could have spent my whole career not touching a chemical, really, but I chose to get more involved in that side. So, I mean, as a scientist, you can choose whether the communication of your science is more important and go down a sales or a training role. Or if you love the lab work, then obviously you can look out for research positions or positions in bigger companies. And I always say, I mean, there's a couple of people ask me what it's like in Australia, and I'd say, well, look, go to the cosmetic society first, have a look for a local society and contact them. And that's what I did when I was going to emigrate to Australia. I contacted the Australian society and got a couple of contacts and joined the society, and then you started, you're in on the loop and you find out what's going on. And if you can't find a local chapter, a local group, well, you can go to the Federation, the IFSCC. So that's what I'd advise people, and then to start having a look and actually maybe talking to some cosmetic chemists and seeing how they do things, because there's a world of difference between a smaller company where you might be expected to do everything and you might enjoy doing everything to working to a big multinational where your job is to make your, I don't know, do micro work or something. But definitely join the society or try and get hold of your cosmetic society people first.
Yeah, you talked about you had taken an advanced course, but there are also advanced degrees offered. Do you see a big benefit in getting an advanced degree?
Yeah, look, I think it depends on your personality, really. I mean, I was really glad to get out of uni, but now I probably appreciate it more. I think if you're very set on certain things, I mean, I've got friends who did PhDs in, you know, plant biotechnology and analytical chemistry, and certainly if you've got a focus and you know, or even physiology, you know, more medical sort of side of things, it definitely can help you, and it can help you to get a better starting point in the industry, I guess. But not everybody has that kind of, they can't always think forward what they want to do. So I don't, for some people, yes, it would help. But for others, I don't think it matters. You know, just join a company. I know a couple of the big guys over here, you know, they take on junior, if you've got a chemistry degree or a science degree, they'll take you on. And, you know, you go through a rotational program of trying each department and seeing what works.
Yeah, that sounds like, that'd be a great opportunity for somebody new.
Yeah, it is. It is. Because often you don't know what you're going to like. It's so hard, if you think back to what it's like as, you know, a 20-year-old or whatever, and just finishing uni or whatever, to decide what you want to do. Because, like I said before, you haven't really, you've always done science. You haven't necessarily done applied science. And there's a vast difference when you start applying it to a real-life situation. I think that the most important thing for people who are starting out is to find what you're passionate about, really, because at the end of the day, it's that will drive you forward. And that's what I've always said. I mean, starting up my business wasn't really a financial decision. It was an emotional decision. It's something that fit. You have to come to a point where you know what you want. And I mean, pursuing doing all this writing and research and the cosmetic kitchen things, all of these things I do because I feel that it's actually... it's something that I enjoy doing and that actually people are getting a benefit from, as opposed to I'm just turning up to work and I'm paying my bills and I'm, you know, I think that's it. I think passion and finding something that can be your life sort of focus is very rewarding.
So you've probably seen cosmetic science change a little bit over the years. Where do you see it going next? What are the sort of the research opportunities for somebody new coming into the industry?
Well, look, I think we've got to value our resources more. I'm interested in every aspect of green chemistry, which for me means doing things smarter and getting more bang for your buck with regard to the ingredients that you use, and I suppose making things more equitable, both for so that the products are more available for lots of different people, and that we're valuing the resources that go into them. So I think linking cosmetic science to the environmental outcomes of the products you're making to me is very interesting, and I think there's still a lot of work to be done on looking at life cycle analysis and the ingredients that we use and the way that people are using products. So that's interesting. There's also a lot of other work to be done on the interaction of our products, which is science, and it's also a bit of philosophy or psychology, I guess, how our products are used. I'm getting involved in a conference in Malaysia next month with the Muslim community. They're looking at halal cosmetics and a halal standard. And it doesn't have to be a halal thing. It doesn't have to be, you know, anything in particular, but there's a lot of opportunity for us as an industry to look at how, say, a Muslim community would use products and what their needs would be, or how an environmental group would look at your products. So all these other things, all these little niche areas that maybe we need to apply a scientific sort of method to, but also put a bit of the human element in it too, and see, well, what do people actually need from our product, and come up with solutions that work and that are based on finding the best solutions for the environment and for the people involved, as opposed to just doing something that quickly makes you a dollar.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. You can get in touch with Miss Foxenhill through her website, realizebeauty.com. You could also follow her on Twitter and connect with her on LinkedIn. Thank you so much, Amanda, for coming on the program, and we look forward to speaking with you again.
That's lovely, Perry. Thank you, the world's most famous cosmetic chemist.
All right, that brings us to the challenge portion of the show. Now, Kelly's not here, but I will challenge you. Here is a word puzzle, and if you know the answer, or you can get the answer, just leave a comment in the challenges page on chemistcorner.com. All right, you ready for the challenge? Here we go. Perfume manufacturers are bringing out new fragrances for the coming season. Ralph Lauren has 4 new fragrances. Christian Dior has 5. And Givenchy has 2 new fragrances. Given that information, how many new scents will be promoted by Yves Saint Laurent? Now, this one might help if you see the names written down, so you can do that by checking out the challenge page or just writing them down yourself. Good luck! Okay, that's it. Just a few quick announcements before we go. I've got 2 classes coming up in the next few months. On April 27, 2010, I'm giving a course on how cosmetic chemists can productively use the internet. Then I'll be teaching the beginning cosmetic chemistry course on June 2, 2010 in Long Island, just before the SCC mid-year meeting. But perhaps the biggest news is that towards the end of March, we here at Chemist Corner will be launching an online training course which will teach you all the ins and outs of becoming the best cosmetic chemist you can be. Keep listening and check the Chemist Corner website for more information. And if you haven't signed up for our Chemist Corner newsletter, you can do that by going to the ChemistCorner.com website and filling in the box on the right-hand side. As always, if you have any questions and comments about cosmetic science or the show, go to the ChemistCorner.com website and leave the feedback there. Also, you can follow us on Twitter. We are Chemist Corner. We have a Facebook page you can become a fan of, and you can connect to both me and Kelly on LinkedIn. Just look at the About page on Chemist Corner for more details. All right, thanks for tuning in, everybody. Now, go make a difference.